It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for coming. Today we want to look a little more at the topic God and randomness. This is a topic that seems to be underrepresented in the literature that you read here. One of the reasons for that is what Tom and I are trying to do is merge the general areas of science, technology, engineering, and math is like in one space, and a second space is religion, philosophy, humanities, another space. So what we're trying to do is merge that, and the topic is God and randomness. My co-author here, Tom McFall, has been a real pleasure, Tom, working with you, and I've learned a lot. Thank you so much for that. So here's the question. The basic question is really pretty simple. We all experience a lot of randomness in our lives. How we met our spouses, accidents, illnesses, other things that seem to happen to us without any purpose. Randomness in this case means absence of purpose or explanations. So the question is, how can God be influential in our lives and in human history in the presence of all this randomness? And that's a topic we're dealing with. This is the third of six presentations. And I will try to wrap up by 11:45 or so. And then that'll give us 10 minutes or so for questions and discussion. But Tom and I will stick around after we're done for any follow-up one-on-one that you'd care to have. So last time we talked about space. There are two basic fundamental areas in physics that events are tied to. One is space, the three dimensions, length, width, and depth, and time, the fourth dimension. So we have space and time. So this week we're going to talk a little bit more about time. When you publish a book, one thing you can do to encourage people to take a look at your themes and consider seriously what you have to say is ask some opinion leaders in the field to read your manuscript and then say something, write a blurb, hopefully endorse your book. One of our endorsers works right here, close by, a couple blocks from here, at Perkins School of Theology, Alice McKenzie, who has a national reputation in homiletics and goes around and gives seminars and discussions to help clergy be more effective in their preaching. So when she wrote, "God and Randomness Challenges Readers to Rethink Their Assumptions About Randomness Using a Lively Writing Style That Draws on Autobiography of the Authors and a Profound Knowledge of History, Science, and Religion," that was nice to read. So here's a little sketch, images here. So what we're dealing with in time here, let me just refer to this monitor here, and you can go over there, kind of refer to, point out something. So if we start here, say at the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago, and we'll say a little more about this, and the formation of galaxies eventually about 4.5 billion years ago, we had the formation of the solar system here. And this image here shows the five planets out to Jupiter with an asteroid in the middle there. Eventually, we come to about 200,000 years ago. The anatomically modern humans first appeared in what many people think is now Kenya in East Africa. So how did this occur? So I submit, and we covered this is a little bit of review from last week. I submit that there are basically three answers to that question. How did this occur? Three basic answers. Answer number one is, it occurred because it occurred because it's all random. It's all natural, natural events. The atomic particles, electrons, quarks, protons, neutrinos. That's all there is. There is no reality beyond the material. There's no reality beyond the natural. And so, since God doesn't exist, it's all random anyway, the problem goes away. And my response to that is, I would encourage you to reject that answer, and here's why. When you look at the laws of nature and how life formed on this planet and the life that we see around us today, it turns out that if you took most natural laws and you just tweaked them a little bit, plus or minus a 0.1% one way, plus or minus 0.1% another way, it turns out the universe very quickly becomes non-life friendly. In our first book, God Is Here to Stay, chapter 3, we have a table there of 19 total natural laws in there that show that a little tweaking one way or the other makes the universe very non-friendly to life. There's a second reason I propose that you reject the atheistic hypothesis, which is the natural laws that we do describe the world that we live in a natural law, are almost all of them are mathematical in character. And when you look at the greats in scientific history, the people who've made the most substantial contributions, almost all of them, when you read them, will talk about the beauty of the natural laws, the associated mathematics that go with it. And I submit to you, if it was all random and unguided, then you wouldn't get natural laws that have this internal beauty. To kind of illustrate the idea of time here, I think we all know what it is, but indulge me a little bit with a little story. My wife Joyce and I are traveling in Oklahoma. We're going to go to a wedding. Got to be there at a certain time. We're on the expressway. Joyce is driving. I'm in the passenger seat. Joyce obeys the rules. She's driving 55 miles an hour, which was the speed limit at that time. And I tell her, being a little more conscious of the time, you know, it'd be all right if you bumped that up to 60. This precipitated about a 15-minute discussion on the ethics of driving 5 miles an hour over the speed limit. 10 minutes later, we come over a little brow of a hill. There's some guys at the bottom pointing something at us. Get to the bottom. The state trooper stops Joyce. Ma'am, do you know how fast you were going? Yes, I was going 60. You know what the speed limit is, don't you? Yes, I do, 55. Joyce got cited. So, Joyce was grumpy after that. Like somehow it was my fault for your illegal behavior. Well, that happened 25 years ago, and I'm still hearing about it. Here's a diagram I showed you last week. This is and last week was in terms of space, but now we want to focus on time here. And this looks like an elongated bell here. So let me kind of summarize what you're looking at here. This image represents the history of the universe. If you plot left to right down the axis of the bell, that represents time, all the way from the Big Bang, which is here, which is shown as quantum fluctuations, all the way up to here where we are now. And this is the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe. And I just show you this as a summary of how things developed in time here. For those of you who are cosmologists, maybe, this is a microwave background that occurred roughly 400,000 years after the Big Bang. There's a period of darkness when matter was starting, the gases, especially hydrogen, was starting to come together. The first stars start to ignite about 400 million years after the Big Bang, and then so forth. And we'll talk a little bit about this in a minute. The solar system and our sun was formed from a second generation star. How do we know that? We know that because the elements that we have on Earth are heavier than lead. So it's one of the indicators that this is a second generation star. So we'll talk about that in a minute. This is a two-dimensional plot of what we were just looking at here. Maybe it's a little more understandable here. This is time, and this represents the radius of the universe, or space, here. And so this is the curve that we were on here for the radius of the universe here. We see over here a little upward curvature here, and the interpretation of that is that has to do with the dark, what's called dark energy. What it really means is we don't really understand why the expansion of the universe is accelerating, which is indicated by that upward curvature there. So we'll give it like a little placeholder name, and we'll call it dark energy here. I wanted to show you a little bit about just touch on a few of the highlights on the evolution of the solar system. The first generation star that exploded in a supernova and was one of the processes for making the heavier elements, trans lead elements here, then formed a lot of the material in this upper left spherical type object here that's showing a rotation here. And also there was a lot of helium there. And then as time went on, there was this rotation kind of elongated the middle part around the equator. And then the sun started to form in this spherical looking part, and it continued to rotate there. Then eventually, about 4.5 billion years ago or so, the sun ignited and started the thermonuclear fusion reactor, which now supplies us with radiation and has supplied radiation for the plants and animals that went into that, some of which eventually formed all that oil underneath the Texas landscape here. That energy ultimately came from the sun. Out in this disk here, where we have material from that first generation star that exploded here, some of the protoplanets started to form. And this picture right here, so this is a top view of what it might look like here. This is a picture here of what the early solar system might have looked like. And I want the take-home lesson on that picture is, notice the randomness associated with that picture. All of the grains of sand, all the boulders, all the material that's starting to clump together eventually when gravity becomes important to form these protoplanets here. We were in, over the week, this past week, we were in the Houston Space Museum. By the way, a really first-class experience. And one of the issues I was thinking about while at the Space Museum was, why was it that our country spent, you know, in the neighborhood of $4 to $6 billion a year during the space program to NASA, and there wasn't any direct, you know, commercial benefit from that? So you would think the return on investment would be really pretty, really low. and certainly wouldn't justify that kind of expenditure. Now, there have been a lot of spin-off technologies from that, but that's not the main reason that NASA was formed. We went to the moon and we're exploring space now. It has to do, in my opinion, with the human spirit. We want to know what's out there. We want to know what's in space. We want to know, is there life other places besides Earth here? So maybe that's kind of the same. Maybe that's kind of the same reason you're here now. You want to know some more about your faith. How does your faith connect with the world you live in? So maybe, you know, I hope your experience today is helpful in that area. I made this little table here to kind of emphasize the randomness associated with the solar system and the Earth formation here. So this column here on the left, the third column to the left over here on that monitor there, has a title on top, What Was Random? The next column has a column title that says Effects of Randomness, and the last column there are comments. So this table and the next one on the next slide, a continuation of this table here, is a method to kind of emphasize the randomness associated with our solar system and the formation of the Earth. So what was randomness on this top line in green here? The energies and directions of individual atoms and molecules that formed the proto-sun were random. You know, maybe every once in a while you'd get two hydrogen atoms that came together with at the high enough energy level that they would fuse, form helium, and the excess energy would come out as radiation, which is what's happening now. But at the atomic and molecular level, highly random. So the effect is the sun eventually lit and became a fusion reactor, and this energy from the sun drove most of the evolution of life on Earth here. Rather important. Next one down, energies and directions of individual atoms and molecules formed our protoplanets, especially Earth. What lit up the sun? It was when two hydrogen atoms came together to form a helium, and that produces extra energy from the atomic nucleus, and that energy then gets converted into a radiation or a light that we see now as light, and there's lots of other wavelengths involved with that. So that's what lit up. It's that nuclear reaction there. Thank you. This is similar. This one in red, this row in red, is kind of similar to the green row up here. Evolutionary path of our Earth's development and the platform of life. That was the effect of this randomness here. All the particles, the sand-like particles and stones and boulders and small asteroid-type particles coming together. Eventually, work together to form the Earth. The time development of the early Earth. This is top one in green I'm looking at now. Okay, the time development of early Earth. One of the effects of the randomness was the Earth retains its atmosphere. At those early times, the atmosphere contained almost no oxygen, which we depend on right now. And that came about because early in the development of life, a cyanobacteria developed that learned how to photosynthesize the energy from the sun, producing a sugar, and an off product was oxygen that we now agree here. This last one I've got here in red is about the energies and direction of large objects. There, the theories now are that one theory is that water and some organic molecules were delivered to the Earth by asteroids and meteorites from outer space here. So I'm calling this random because it randomly impacted the Earth, but it doesn't have to impact the Earth. It could bypass the Earth, go someplace else. So I also want to touch on, in the little bit of time we have left here, some of the highlights on the origin of life here on this planet. 3.8 billion years ago, an amazing thing happened on this planet here. Shocking. Just before the event, all matter was lifeless, didn't reproduce, there's no genetic code. Boom, life occurs. Maybe it occurred multiple places around the planet. Maybe it occurred and then it got wiped out, started up again, got wiped out again. Number of starts and stops. Don't know exactly what happened. And the life is, the current theory is life is thought to occur 3.8 billion years ago. And there are seven explanations for this. None are widely accepted. This is an extremely hard problem to solve. We don't know exactly what the conditions were on the early Earth, and a number of reasons why this problem hasn't been solved yet. So here in blue, how does a diverse collection of non-living molecules random come together and morph into the first living cells? And so what I'm pointing out here in this slide is that randomness was a key here. Now that doesn't crowd out the Christian or the religious explanation that God had a hand in this. In fact, we'll talk more about that in the last presentation here. I also wanted to summarize for you some major mass extinction events that occurred on the life forms that occurred from when life started 3.8 billion years ago until now. It turns out that there were major mass extinction events, and I've listed six of them here. The first one occurred 650 million years ago, where the Earth was a snowball Earth, and because of the severe coldness, 70% of the dominant sea plants went extinct. 443 years ago, here in blue, 49% of all life vanished. 374 million years ago, in red, 70% of all marine species died. This is a big one here. 252 million years ago, 96% of all ocean species and 70% of all land species were wiped out. And then we had another one at 201 years ago. 20% of all marine species vanished 65 million years ago. This is the one that where a meteor struck what is now the Yucatan, and there was 80% of the marine life, 85% of the land species died. The dinosaurs disappeared, and when the dinosaurs disappeared, that opened up environmental niches for mammals to populate and to thrive and develop here. I want to read to you something from Discover Magazine. This is a magazine you can pick up at your newsstand. This is Discover. It's Science for the Curious. This is a March 2018 issue. I picked this up at O'Hare Airport just before coming down here. There's a little article in here called A Killer Connection. New research ties mass extinctions to the rocks beneath our feet. And it talks about some of these mass extinction events, especially the one at 252 million years ago, which says about 90% on Earth of 90% of life on Earth was snuffed out in our planet's biggest known extinction called the Great Dying. I want to give you the last summary statement in this article. It says, quote, "So really, mass extinctions often just boil down to bad luck. It's bad luck not only that the impactor struck the Earth, but the topic of this article is it also depends on where that impactor strikes on Earth, the what kind of soil lies beneath. Some soils have little impact on life. Other soils with the same amount of energy from the impactor have a large effect in the amount of debris they distribute into the atmosphere and tend to suppress life." Quote, "My lesson from this is that the Earth can go through dramatic changes. The planet doesn't particularly care about the biology on it, including humans." There'll be chances to question and discuss here in a minute here, okay? Okay. Just a little brief little summary of the appearance of Homo sapiens, anatomically modern humans. We saw there was a Cambrian explosion of life 535 million years ago, when all of a sudden there appeared in the record many phyla, plants, animals. This one in green here, for those of you looking at that monitor over there, certain fishes evolved fin bones strong enough to bear their weight on land. Without those fin bones, the vertebrates might never have developed. So the evolution of life, the current theory is, depends on these genetic mutations in the DNA, which is a twisted double helix, and there are base pairs between the two support structures there. And if one of those base pairs gets struck by a cosmic ray or something else happens in it, to change that, a mutation occurs. And if the animal or the organism is better adapted to the environment that they're in because of this mutation, then that is favored, and that's the explanation. Not universally accepted, but that's the current dominant thinking on that. Then we just mentioned the asteroid impact 65 million years ago. 4.4 million years ago, the first hominid, precursor to us, to Homo sapiens, developed bipedalism. We stood upright, and the advantage of that was there was more efficient use of energy, body temperature. It was easier to see the predators in the savannas where they lived, and the hands were free to use tools. And then, as I've already mentioned, about 200,000 years ago, we have the first humans appear, and also appearing at that time where we have the first record of kind of advanced tools. There were some tools in primates before that, but here we have more advancement of tools. We also see our first evidences of religion there that occurred right there 200,000 years ago. Also, we see evidence of language. People started to live in clans and small communities and would hunt together. And my favorite indicator here is the last one. What you see is migrations around the planet. People emigrated out of Africa and into the Asia, and some of them crossed the water to Australia and crossed a lot more water into the South Sea Islands and so forth. Some followed the large game across the Bering Land Bridge and into North America and South America here. So, we're quickly reaching our discussion time. A brief summary: Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago, first stars start to burn in green, 13.4 billion years ago. Solar system forms 4.5 billion years ago. Earth starts to form 4.1 billion years ago. The Earth goes through a lot of impacts, and a lot of times during an impact, most of the water, maybe all the water, gets evaporated. As soon as the Earth is ready to sustain life, boom, you see life, 13.8 billion years ago. So each stage has a high degree of randomness. So where is God in all of this? So who would have guessed? So next week we talk about on March 11. Who would have guessed randomness in World War I, Great Depression and New Deal, World War II, the Cold War, terrorism? That will be discussed by my good friend and co-author Tom McFall, who will take you the rest of the way. At the end of our journey, we have a speculative answer to this, that we don't have real data on this, but it is a speculation, and I'd hope it helps you on your faith journey here. So that's it. Thank you for your attention. Yes.
So
Jennifer, the attorney.
Yeah. So if you know, there's a search for life out there in the universe,
right,
underway, looking for the Goldilocks, you know, planets and places where there could be life. If they find it, what does it say about God and randomness? And if they don't find it, what does it say about it? I mean, other than, there's no way to completely rule it out, obviously, so there will always be a question. But if they find evidence of life elsewhere, what does it say about how God fits into this randomness?
The question is, in our search for life, extraterrestrial life beyond this planet here, if we find it, what implications does that have for our religious understanding of the world and universe we live in? And if they don't find it, what does that have to do with our religious understanding here? Our book is just 230 pages long. And if we dealt with everything, you know, you'd get to a size like War and Peace pretty soon here. But that's a great question, and I've wondered that myself. And you know what? I don't have a good answer for it. I don't know. I hope it doesn't suppress us on our faith journey, and I hope it leads to greater understanding of the universe we live in and God that created it. Let me also say, I did mention the three responses to how all this occurred: atheism, agnosticism. I didn't mention agnosticism or theism. Agnosticism is, I would contend, a give-up position. We don't know if there's a God. How can we know? All right? Well, our whole experience as humans is to be curious. Is there a Higgs boson? So we go out and spend $1 billion+ on the Large Hadron Collider. Is there life outside our planet here? We want to know that. So there's a lot of funds, you know, $4 billion+ per year during the Gemini and programs and the other programs that NASA has. So I hope we will continue our curiosity to address that question. But also, it's a very active field right now because they've discovered, I think it's over 10,000 what are called exoplanets, planets that are circling stars outside of our own solar system here. Thank you, Jennifer. Yes.
Well, probably everybody else understands this, but I thought your years in your chart, this happened on this billion years, this happened this billion years. How can you be so specific about all that? I don't mean you, but I mean the scientists. How can that be so specific?
There's lots of data. The question is, how can you be so sure about the years in our chart? So, for example, I said life form 3.8 billion years ago, so forth. The answer for that question, the answer is the fossils that they've discovered, the earliest fossil life forms that they've discovered. And one source is in Sharks Bay, Australia. Called stromatolites, and that they can date that back to 3.4 billion years. So how do they get to 3.8? The answer is those earliest life forms were too complicated to just form kind of on their own from lifeless material that was there. So it's kind of a guess, an extrapolation back to that. But it is pretty universally accepted. The dates for the mass extinctions, similar kind of answer. They try to determine what caused the extinction, the volcanic eruption, some impactor came, or an ice age. So they try to match up those dates with other indicators, other data. It's as much as possible, it's data driven. Okay? Thank you. Yes.
I've been wondering during this about the, and I don't know, just in a thumbnail mm-hmm. answer, the super collider. I've read about things that they're discovering, and I can't remember, just mm-hmm. that they're experimenting with. How does that super collider, those findings impact what we're talking about? Is there any correlation at all?
How does the super collider affect our discussion on God and randomness? Is that a fair summary? Okay. The super collider gives us data that helps us better understand the basic structure of matter. So matter has got the most fundamental particles are quarks and mesons and other things. So it turned out in our understanding, there was a big hole there that we didn't know or didn't have. Everything else fit. It's like there has to be something in this hole over here, which was a Higgs boson. So that's the main reason the super collider was built, to look for data, look for evidence on that, which they eventually did find, too, about three, four years ago.
They called the God particle.
Yes, the God particle. Leon Lederman, a Nobel laureate, was a previous director of Fermilab, which is about 20 miles from where I live, wrote a book called The God Particle. And as you know, titles of books have an influence on sales volume. So, but it was a good book. I recommend it to you, too, if you have a chance to read it. Yes?
Think of science as things we can know with a certain degree of confidence.
Yes.
You shoot a bullet right here at my heart, I'm going to die.
Yes.
That means randomness is the things that we don't know for sure.
Yes.
And that would be the realm that God could act in, which is outside
yes.
of the laws.
Yes. You so got it.
Randomness is the area that God can act in.
Think, here's my suggestion. So the question is, if we think of natural laws in terms of an exact predictable outcome, but there's also a fuzz, an uncertainty. It might be plus or minus 5%. So it's kind of like polling Americans on election night, where we predict the result is 55% plus or minus 3%. So is it possible God acts in that randomness here? And I think my guess is that my good friend Tom McFall will answer that in the affirmative in 3 weeks from now, which I hope you attend here. But another way to look at it is if you take a radio, an AM radio, amplitude modulation radio, okay, and drive 50 miles from the broadcast tower, turn it on, you can hear some music, but you also hear some static in the background. So the randomness, like the static, The music is like the predictable natural law. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm following up to her. This magnetic wave that they detected recently, does that have anything to affect with how many billion years ago?
Magnetic wave in connection with what, they, the Earth?
Said, yeah, that they it proved the Big Bang and also Einstein's theory.
Yes, that was one of the evidences that go into support the Big Bang. And of course, Einstein's general theory of relativity has been subjected to many tests, and it has passed every single one. So it's almost certainly the way time and space work and produce gravitational type effects.
Well, did that go back to the Big Bang?
You know what, I'm gonna have to read on that here. I think it does, but I don't wanna give you false information either. Okay, thank you. Okay, one last question.
How do you use the term randomness across such different scales? Because like quantum mechanics is inherently probabilistic, so you could never truly know the position and velocity of the particle. But for an asteroid, you certainly could predict the trajectory or the position of an asteroid if you had more information. So how do you call something random versus how do you say you just lack?
Great question. The question is, how do you define randomness in terms of an asteroid, which is fundamentally different than quantum mechanics, which has a fundamental randomness built in, an irreducible randomness that's built in? And the what we're calling randomness is the chaotic nature of all of those particles that are impacting on each other, going off at unpredictable angles. And so it's more of the chaos that's associated with the randomness we're talking about, whereas the quantum mechanical randomness is.
So it's more of a complexity.
I'm sorry.
Complexity.
Yes.
Scales.
We're going to be around later. We're under the tyranny of the clock. Thank you so much for your attention. Here.